Morning, good afternoon, good evening, whenever you are listening. This is Ben Gujan with Quad City Arts, and welcome back to Talking Art, supported by Quad City Bank and Trust. Today, I am thrilled to be talking art with someone who I have heard about for a long time, but have never actually met until today, and that is award-winning filmmaker Stephen Folker of Folker Films. Stephen, welcome to Talking Art.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I've heard your name bandied about. I'm newish to the Quad Cities, and I have a background in the film industry. So when I got here, was looking up filmmakers in the area and saw you, and then the world closed down, and I had a baby, and life changed, and so priorities changed. But you're kind of a mainstay in the Quad Cities film scene here. How'd you make that happen?
I don't know. I don't even know why I'm here.
well, how'd you get into film? You're here. So I follow you on Facebook, which all of you fine folks can do as well, at Folker Films. And I saw some stills from a recent project you had been working on. And one thing that's always, and we'll get into this more later, always impressed me when I see your social media stuff is how cinematic the images you create are. And I'm like, man, all those shots always look fantastic. And I was like, saw these recent stills from this project. And I was like, I would love to talk to Stephen.
Well, thank you.
Here we are. How'd you get into filmmaking?
Honestly, it's something, even as a kid, like a lot of people, I used to make backyard films and then put them on the public access channel. And then I would knock on the neighbor's doors and pass out flyers and watch my little show. And anyways, as an adult, I became a photographer. Mm-hmm. So I have a photography company, and I've done that for 22 years.
Yeah.
And one day, just kind of out of the blue, I reconnected with an old friend from school. And he had an interest in animation and me in film. And I'm like, why don't we make a movie? Let's just make something and have fun.
Yeah.
And so with that, originally, you can laugh at me, I was thinking, all right, I'm going to be an actor and a director and a writer and the whole nine yards. And I hired this film crew out of Chicago. They were like film school graduates.
Yeah.
And I loved it and I hated it because I love the whole like putting it together and talking about lenses and lighting and all this. But I'm thinking, why does it take 14 hours to do two scenes?
Sure.
Now, in a big film, you've been on big sets. You get it. It probably takes forever. But on these little ones, it's like, what are we doing here? So I thought, well, crap, I'm a photographer. I boss people around. That's kind of like directing. And
right.
I know lighting. I mean, I'll do it myself.
Yeah.
So that kind of kickstarted me making a lot of independent films. And then each project, I was trying to learn something else, like distribution or, I guess how to work with actors better, how to get better camera angles and mm-hmm. so forth. And then fast forward, during the pandemic, I got a little bit of a break in which sense I pitched a short film to Iowa PBS and they backed it. They gave me a little bit of money and I made it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got this email from this company. They'd seen one of my films at a festival.
Yeah.
And I thought it was phony baloney and I deleted the email. Seriously, I thought, this is too official. This doesn't read real.
Sure.
And then I thought, well, what if it is? So I found the email.
Yeah.
I called the phone number probably a week or two late, and it was a producer for some new program.
Mm-hmm.
No idea what it was. They just needed somebody to, like, film an interview in Cedar Rapids.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, okay, piece of cake. Yes, I'm a one-person show. Yes, I can do it. The whole back and forth, because they had all these requirements for what camera you use and audio team, lighting team, the whole nine yards.
Sure.
So after a brief back and forth, I filmed this thing. They liked what I did. They offered for me to film the whole thing solo because it's during the pandemic. They couldn't fly people in.
Sure.
And I was talking to the editor, and I knew they were affiliated with some bigger things.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what is this for? He's like, oh, it's going to air on A&E and be on Hulu. And I was like, oh.
That's sweet.
That's cool. So I did a bunch of those. I think I filmed 7 or 8 of those solo.
Yeah.
And then I did some standalone specials. And then last year, they had called me, and I worked on a episode for HBO. So that's like my big credits.
Sure.
But other than that, I do a lot of independent films, shorts and features, some for clients, some for myself, that kind of thing.
Well, you know, it's interesting, like talking about kind of that docudrama, true crime or
yeah.
docuseries. Like that's kind of how I got my foot in the door with the larger film and TV world as well.
Really?
Was doing a bunch of shows for, it was all the like murder shows, like Love in the Cornfield with Murder. I don't even remember the names right now, but those sort of sensationalized docudrama, like the true crime things, and got cast in several of those. And those were kind of my first experience on a larger set, you know, in the reenactment portion. And it was kind of at the time when those reenactments were going from like very non-scripted and shadowy to like, oh, we want to bring this to a higher cinematic level mm-hmm. for these sorts of things. And they still didn't have scripts, but they were like, you're going to improv some dialogue.
Yeah.
And starting to include that stuff. But yeah, like I learned so much on those sets about, and it's down and dirty way faster than like a feature or a television show. Like you get so many reps in doing that.
Yeah, it's. I know the feeling because I know with a lot of the episodes, it was. The B-roll you had to be so quick because, like, you know, it's a true crime show, mm-hmm. so you're filming a lot of detectives and attorneys and stuff like that, and these are busy people. They're not going to give you an hour of their time. It's like, hey, you know, you got 20 minutes, and then I got to get back out, and then you're like really rushing it to get like the four or five key shots that look cool when you watch it on TV.
Right.
But the actual interview portion, that stuff they're a little bit more picky about with the lighting and stuff. And, you know, they'd want me to get there like, I don't know, an hour and a half, 2 hours early.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for me, I'm quick. I have the lights ready in like 15 minutes. But then it's like, you know, send me a shot. No, move it over a millimeter. Send it a shot. Move it over another millimeter. I mean, really micro, you know.
Sure.
But at the end of the day, it's their program and they have a vision. And when you work under somebody, you have to be respectful of that and go, they know what they want.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, how did, you know, I mean, that's one of the things when I watch, I think, something that's low budget versus a higher budget TV or film production, one of the things that is most evident to me is the lighting.
Yeah.
You know, and like I mentioned earlier, like I look at your work and it always has a very cinematic quality and looks good and looks really well lit. Like, is that just from your photography background? And tell me about photography. Like,
how
you got into that.
Well, so true story. I wanted to go to film school when mm-hmm. I was younger, but college really wasn't in the books for me and my brothers. And so I got into photography. That was like the next medium I think I could do.
Sure.
And always secretly wanting to do film. Yeah. But with photography, I mean, a lot of photography, in my opinion, is you walk into a space and you look at where the natural light is coming in and then you kind of fill it in from there.
Sure.
Right? And with film, it's very much the same. But the difference with film, and this is just me as a self-taught filmmaker, is you want to add shadow if possible. Right? Shadows look interesting in film. If we were doing a headshot of you, we don't want a bunch of crazy shadows. Right? It's a little bit different. And so really, that to me, that's just the key of it. I don't think you have to have a fancy camera. You know, anybody that says, you know, hey, if you shoot on a Red, it looks better than a mirrorless Sony, they don't know what they're talking about. They don't understand lighting.
Sure.
It's lens and lighting and just composition. And if you understand that, you can make anything look good.
Yeah.
I just go into a room and I look at the space and go, this is where the light's coming from. And I'm going to put a light there and I'm going to put a light there. And let's put a little fill right there. And I just play. I don't overthink it.
Sure. Well, and that, you know, you brought up composition. And I feel like all your work that I've looked at over the last couple of days and in prep, like you have a really strong sense of composition as well. Is that something that you kind of innately had growing up, or how did you develop that?
I think it's just always been something that, that naturally came to me.
Yeah.
You know, I just, I know it's kind of weird. Like I walk into a room and I see different shots and things framed up in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even when I walk in, you know, I'm like looking and going, hey, that's a cool photo right there.
Right.
Right. But it'd probably be awkward if I would just randomly stop and take photos of everybody. But it's just the way my brain is wired.
Yeah.
And even too, when I'm filming a project, even if I put a whole shot list together, you know, and make 80 pages of these are all the shots I'm going to do, when I get there on set, I can't do it. I just have to like wing it. It's the way my brain works.
Sure.
But
sure. Well, and I noticed in your biography that, and not that this is how he necessarily works, but you know, you kind of talk about that, kind of the pride of being like a low budget filmmaker who can make stuff work. And that inspiration from Robert Rodriguez and Rebel Without a Crew. And like, I remember reading that book when I was, you know, late teens and just being like, oh, this is amazing. Like, this guy did this. And then yeah. he made El Mariachi and it was incredible. And it seems like you have a bit of that ethos as well.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, it's part of is because, you know, I'm in the Midwest. I'm in the Quad City region. I mean, there's not a bunch of films being made here.
Right.
So, but also too, that, you know, when I'm working with different clients, sometimes we don't have $5 million to work with. Right. You know what I mean? So you have to get creative with your resources.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think too, if you have too many cooks in the kitchen, it doesn't always equate to a better project.
Sure.
You have to have the skilled people in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And skilled people can cost a lot of money.
Right.
So then you have to decide, it's like, okay, I can get this guy who's okay, and maybe isn't going to do anything but hurt my film or learn how to do that portion and forego that guy, you know?
Right. Well, I think that brings up an interesting point of, for me, and my background was theater before I kind of transitioned into more film, and that was more just on the acting side of things. But like my producer head, because I've done a lot of theater producing and I've thought about film a lot, the upfront financial barrier of film seems so much harder to overcome. Like theater, I get it's like, I'm going to put on this show and I'm going to sell some tickets and get the money from selling the tickets. Film, there is no guarantee of that money ever coming back in.
Yeah.
How do you kind of navigate the world of funding and distribution, and what are some of the things you've learned about that?
Well, I mean, I always tell people I'm not an expert in distribution. I know just enough to sound like I know more, I guess. But
sure.
I think here's the thing. When you make a film, yes, you have to raise money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the way I look at it is you look at how much money you have to work with. You can make a feature film for as low as $5,000 if you're creative.
Right.
You can do it for $100,000, $500,000, whatever. You have to look at what you have to work with, and then how much stuff can you get for free?
Sure.
Now, a lot of people, and this is a really, you know, depending on who you talk to, can be a hot topic about copy credit, not doing stuff for free.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you think community theater is?
Right.
You're working for free. Somebody's selling a ticket, making the money, and it's not you. Or if you're a prop builder at a theater, you're working for weeks for free. You know, or if you intern at a production company, you're working for free. You're getting experience, mm-hmm. you know. So I guess it depends. If you're kind of just starting out, you're only worth what someone's willing to pay you.
Right.
If you don't have any real experience and somebody's giving you a shot, maybe you should be paying them. You know what I mean? But I do pay all my actors, by the way. But when I first started, I just made stuff to make stuff.
Sure.
But I think anybody can make a film, but to have somebody else give you money, you're going to have to know the right circle. And if you don't,
right.
you're going to have to save a little bit of money.
Right.
And you can make money on the back end. I mean, nowadays with distribution, a lot of it is you're going to go to like streaming platforms like Tubi or Amazon Prime.
Sure.
And there's nothing wrong with that. There are filmmakers making six figures on Tubi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just some crappy site that anyone can get onto. You know?
Right.
So you have to have a game plan, but you also have to talk to a film sales agent first and say, hey, what's selling right now?
Right.
You know, and I do that every few months, and different companies have different titles that they sell a lot of.
Sure.
Right? Like one company might go, we sell a lot of holiday films that are Hallmark-ish, you know, and another one might say, hey, we do faith-based and rom-coms are big right now.
Right.
So if you hit it from that angle, now you know you have a better chance of making money, because with film, if you just make an art piece, you may not make any money.
Right.
Films that you might say, that's garbage, I'd never watch that, what a hunk of crap, sometimes those make a lot of money.
Yeah. I've watched many of those in giant theaters.
Exactly.
That have cost millions of dollars.
Yes. So it's, you know, but it's a business. And if you look at it like a business, you can make money. If you're doing it just to fulfill a dream, then it's more of a passion project. And that's okay, too.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and so, I mean, you kind of seem, it seems like you strike a balance of kind of working with these networks and production companies and kind of producing and directing and shooting the shows that you're working on, and then also your projects that are your passion projects that you're doing. Do you find there's a difference in, maybe not work-wise, how you approach those, but like, say, shooting something for TV versus shooting your own independent film? Does your eye approach those in different ways?
Well, yeah. I mean, so the stuff I've done for TV has all been, like, I've been credited as a cinematographer.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, like, I filmed entire episodes where I did the lighting, the camera, the audio, you just get that one credit.
Sure.
Right? You're just expected to do all that stuff.
Sure.
And probably then some. With independent film, I like it because there's creative control, which I think you should have if you're a director.
Yeah.
And sometimes it just depends on the expectation of the final project. You know what I mean? Everybody has a different goal. Last month, I filmed two short films, and the month before that, I shot a feature.
Mm-hmm.
And the short films, I mean, one was for a client that their child is trying to break into the acting scene a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like, hey, let's just make a project that you can use just to promote them.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And maybe get ahead that way instead of applying to all these projects online that may or may not go anywhere.
Yeah.
Right? And the other one was a gentleman who, he wrote this script like 15 years ago and just really loved it. And I think for him, it was just, he wanted to make it. I don't think it had so much to do with where I'm going to put it other than he was wanting to get this message out there. It had to deal with trafficking. And he just wanted to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I thought that one turned out really cool.
Yeah.
So, I mean, everyone has a different goal.
Mm-hmm.
I shot a passion project a couple months ago, and I did it just because I wanted to do something that was mine. That's it. And, you know, I do have places I can reach out to when it's done, and we'll see what happens. But for me, it's more like, this is my passion project. If I want to go to festivals with it and meet people and network, it's a marketing tool.
Well, and that, you know, that was something as I was kind of working my way up the acting ladder, like, you know, as a film actor, it's like, how do you get a film job? You need a reel, you need film credits to get the job. So how do you do that? So you do some student films or you do a passion project or create your own thing, you know, and that was one thing, like I was getting cast a lot as, you know, in just a couple of very niche types. And, you know, when I would talk with my representatives about how are we going to break out of that, you know, it was always like, write a short film, write a web series, film that, create those own marketing pieces for yourself. And I'm sure from the directing side, it's that same thing. If I'm going to make this short that I can show other producers, so they were like, oh, we think you might be a good fit to work on this larger project.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely a great idea. And I know some people might go, oh, I don't have the finances to do that. And it's like, what do you spend on headshots and acting classes and going to mixers and buying clothes for your headshots and all your subscriptions for casting sites? I mean, that stuff can add up to thousands of dollars.
Yep.
That could be a short film that could launch your career.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's your priorities. Everybody doesn't have their priorities in the right place. And even me, it's like with actors I work with, you know, some will apply to a project that is below their pay grade, which is understandable, but it's like, why'd you apply? Yeah. I'm not going to negotiate with you. You know what I mean? You want to do it? Great. If not, then kick rocks. Go somewhere else.
Right.
But it's just, it's hard to make a living in this business.
Yeah.
You know, if I was an actor, I'm not, I'm too ugly, but if I was...
There is a role for everyone, and you are not too ugly.
Well, thank you. But but if I was, I would just do, I would focus on commercial work.
Sure.
Because you can get bigger payouts. Not as much as back in the day.
Right.
But it's more money that way, and you meet different ad agencies and companies that you can say, hey, here's my shot, you know.
Yeah.
Call me next time.
Yeah.
You know, actual film projects, it's far and few between the ones that pay good. Mm-hmm. And I think, too, that a lot of people that make smaller budget films, like, let's say, 200K or less,
yeah,
they don't want to deal with unions. No offense, I know you're a SAG guy, right?
Yeah.
Because it's extra paperwork and hassle, and when you get to distribution, it's a pain in the butt. But that, you know what I mean? So a lot of people are going FICOR.
Yeah.
You know, I just worked with an actress that used to be on that show, Facts of Life. Mm-hmm. And she just did a thing on Netflix. She's FICOR.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it just depends. I think people want to make money.
Well, and that's for our audience who may not know what FICOR is. It's short for Financial Corps, but it's a way to be in the union but also work on non-union projects. And it was originally for people who did not agree with the union's political stances. They could withhold some of their dues. Was the intent, but people can use it to do both sides of the...
People that want to work. That's how I look at it.
Yes.
And it's, you know, and I don't have any angst against anybody who wants to stay in the union and stay faithful, or if they go, hey, I'm turning down jobs, I need to do something.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting. Like, when I went SAG, mm-hmm. I talked to and... You don't have to go SAG until you hit your third SAG project.
Right.
And everyone I talked to was like, wait until you have to go. And I booked my third project and signed SAG. And I was talking to lots of friends of mine because I came up in the commercial world for on-camera work. And there were some of them who had gone SAG and stayed SAG and some who had gone SAG. And I had one friend who literally... signed his SAG papers, and then went to the next room in the SAG office and signed his FICOR papers.
Really?
Because he knew he was going to be able to work more. Hmm. And, like, that was my experience. Like, I went SAG, and I was booking, like, day player television roles, but they didn't pay the bills the way commercial work did, and it wasn't as frequent as commercial work did.
Yeah.
So, like, I hadn't had a day job in several years doing commercial work. Mm-hmm. But then I went SAG and started doing more TV and had to, like, pick up more table waiting and catering shifts.
That's interesting.
When I was in the city. And it's like, it's funny because you get the larger prestigious things where people are like, oh, you're on this show. Yep. And then I went and worked a shift at a restaurant.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny you say that. And I can't think of their name, and I wouldn't say who it was if I did know, but
yeah.
There's somebody that's on one of these big shows like Chicago Fire or something like that I heard from an actress. This gal has a pretty big part in the show. I mean, she's not the lead, but she's close to it. She's like in every episode, and she works at a restaurant in Chicago to pay the bills.
Yeah.
That's crazy that somebody has to do that, you know, that they – I mean, it's not that they don't have the budget.
Right.
But I suppose, you know.
Well, and that all depends. And we're getting into the weeds here. But
you
know, if you're, because you can be booked as like a recurring character, but like if you were booked as a recurring co-star, you're only getting the co-star rate, which is like day player rates. And it's not, especially if you're living in a major market, it's hard to make a living doing that unless you're working every single day.
Yeah. And I think it's gotten to the point too where I've had this happen twice where I put up a casting notice and I had some actor email me on my website, and it's people that have had really big roles on big shows I've seen on Netflix and the CW and all that. Not like a little bit part, but like they were in every episode.
Yeah.
They're not super mainstream, but if you look at their face, you're like, oh my God, I've seen you in that show.
Yeah.
Wanting to do stuff. And I talked to one guy, I won't say who it is, but... You know, it's just he said that my agent's not booking me anything anymore. I've booked more stuff by doing it on my own and getting rid of them. And, you know, we talked about the whole FICOR thing and all that.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they still wanted a little bit more than what I think a lot of productions can do. But I guess their sell is, hey, you know, you get me for 2 or 3 days.
Right.
You know, but, you know, each his own. But, you know, it's just you got to get creative, I think.
Yeah. Well, and I think, I think there used to be a stigma against people doing FICOR. And from what I have heard, there are still productions and production companies that will not hire someone if they're FICOR because some people see it as crossing the line. But that as the industry has changed, and this is speaking kind of from my time in New York, which was pre-pandemic, so this may have changed, more and more casting companies didn't really care. They were like, they understood the reality of, hey, 95% of the commercial work is non-union. So a lot of these people who are making a living doing this still need those paychecks. So they're going to do both. And this is the way they can do both.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I've heard that too. I know that there's some actors that think that if you do it, then you're going to get blacklisted or something. And then I've heard from a lot of people that's a myth. You just lose your voting rights and
yeah. Right. I think there's some old heads that are still.
Right. And the people that are afraid to do it, also are the ones that are moaning the most about not having any work and not being able to take on any jobs they want to do. So I think you kind of have to make a decision, you know? Just like that story you said that, when you went to doing shows, it was more prestigious, but then it became harder to make your way.
To piece those pieces together. And, it was such a funny thing. Like, I think in the year before I left, I booked like 9 co-stars on like significant shows on television. And because I didn't have that commercial income anymore, had to start, like I said, catering and waiting tables again.
it is what it is. You have to do what you have to do to pay the bills.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let me ask you this. I mean, I know this is your show, but I mean, what's next for you? I mean, what are you working on?
Right now I'm working on being a dad. It's in an actorly way. I did Fresh Films film that they shot here last summer. So I shot that. And, I'm at a point where like all my kids are very involved in activities. And so that is my priority. But I'm always like, if the right project comes along, we'll figure it out. if I don't do something every like 6 months, I get real squirrely.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And it's like, even for myself, it's like, even if I'm doing a project for a client, I still feel the urge to make something that's my own because it's that feeling when you get there and all these actors, they're not just actors, they're like your family. And you get to hang out with them for a few weeks and have a good time.
Well, and that's one thing I always have loved about theater and, that was my start, but theater and film is like you're dropped into these situations where you have to establish relationships very quickly. And it's like, we're here, we're a family, we're making this thing, and it's going to be brief and intense, and then we're going to say goodbye and on to the next.
Yeah.
And, a lot of those people you usually stay in touch with and, perhaps work with again and say, I loved working with that person. I'm going to bring them back next time. Or however that happens. But for me, that sort of work model, just career-wise, it keeps me engaged and fresh rather than something that I worked as a mail clerk at a bookstore for a while and that got real monotonous. Mm. And I was like, I understand what going postal means right now because I am just doing the same thing every day, versus a life on a set is always different challenges.
Some good, some bad, but it's fun.
Yeah.
It's fun. No, I love it, but I'm looking forward to it as well. Next week, I'm going out of town to film a documentary.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I met this this couple at a film festival, and we got talking, and she's like, you know what, I'm going to hire you, and next thing you know, I'm going to direct and film this thing, it's a cool subject, too. It's about, she's part of a organization that's against firearms, and she wanted to do a film about that, and my angle as a director is, why don't we get different people's perspectives about firearms and make it kind of neutral. You know what I mean? Don't isolate one side over the other. We have enough of that today. Let's just make it very neutral.
Yeah.
And let people decide. So it's going to be pretty cool. We have a person we're going to interview that was a survivor at a mass shooting in a mall. We have somebody that's a trauma surgeon who wrote a best-selling book. And we have somebody who's a hunter that tried to take their own life. So, I mean, kind of like a variety of people.
Yeah.
So it should be pretty interesting.
Well, and that to me is so much more powerful than like something that gets really didactic.
Yeah.
Of this is what to think. You know,
yeah.
Like the best, and I'm a documentary, like that's kind of our go-to is documentaries a lot. But when they just kind of present like this is the information and this is the story.
Yeah, I think it has to be balanced. You know what I mean? Because, you know, you want people, all people, to want to watch your film.
Yeah.
Right? And let them decide. You know, it's kind of like for years there was a debate that if your kid played video games with guns in it that they were going to be some crazy shooter.
Right.
There's a lot of people go, I don't think that's the case. I have a really good kid and
yeah,
they play these video games. So
I played hours of Contra.
See? You seem pretty normal. But
it's the first time anyone said that. Thank you.
That's all right. I play Minecraft, so don't put that on there. But no, so we're kind of working on different things. And I have another documentary I'm trying to wrap up that was financed in part by the Iowa Film Office.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, so that's kind of I'm right at the tail end of getting that done. I just have a couple more reenactments I want to shoot.
Sure.
And additional B-roll. But I'll tell you what, doing a documentary is so much work because I can't tell you how many people that I drove like an hour plus to go interview somebody and spent 30 minutes setting up the lighting. And then the interview was like, I can't use any of this.
Right.
You know, or people sometimes they shut down or they're concerned about what they're saying or how's this going to be used. And it's like, we're not talking about anything bad here.
Right.
You know.
Well, yeah, and as a filmmaker, I guess, how do you approach documentary versus narrative?
Well, documentary, I think it's what I try to do is get an outline in place. So my producing partner on the Texas project, we've kind of put together different people that we would interview, and we've kind of did different like discovery calls where we either keep somebody on board or we go, you know what, this is not going to add anything to the project, or maybe this person's trying to tell us what to do, so let's go ahead and just, you know, cut them loose type approach.
Yeah.
But once we have our you know, interview subjects, then it's a matter of what shots are we going to get to help tell the story so that when we get the talking head shots, mm-hmm. that we have enough interesting B-roll to cut to.
Sure.
And kind of mix it up and, you know, bring it together in other scenes.
I am always curious when I'm watching any film, but especially documentaries, I think, with the B-roll shots. Like, is that something that you are kind of specifically planning out what those shots are going to be of? Or is that something that you're, like, reacting to the situation and, like, oh, I think that B-roll of the coffee cup might be interesting, or the B-roll of those flowers? Does that make sense?
No, that's a good question. And some of it is pre-planned, like for the TV show that we did. It's called Killer Cases. I think it's still on Hulu. But for that, you know, they would kind of give me like a general list of shots they wanted. And it was always kind of similar, like if it was an attorney, we need to see him on the phone or looking through a file. If it was a police officer, he's in the squad car and he's looking out the window.
Sure.
You know, that kind of thing. And then it would just be me improvising and going, hey, that's kind of cool. I like your badge down there. Let me film that real quick. Or let me get a shot of you drinking coffee right here. Or let me get a shot of you walking from that office to that office or looking at these crime scene photos. Oh, don't put those photos up. We can't show those, but these ones work.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. But if it was in a moment, like if we were doing a documentary about you, I would say, all right, Ben, we're going to go ahead and get a mixture of like home, work, and play. I'm going to show you here at the radio station doing stuff. I'm going to show you maybe at a local play performing or practicing at home with your kids. And you just kind of get enough coverage that you can implement that into the interviews.
Sure.
You know.
That's yeah. That always fascinates. What were we watching the other day? The Testament of Anne Lee, the about the woman who founded Shakerism, and they just had some B-roll shots, and I was like, I wonder why they decided on that shot.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, like it always is curious to me, and you know, when I think about putting a film together and editing a film, and you edit some of your own work too, right?
I edit everything now, which I used to farm out the editing.
Sure.
I had different editors I worked with, and a couple of them ripped me off, took my money, and didn't finish the job. And then I had others that would have my film for like a year, and I'm like, dude, where's the movie at?
Right.
Oh, you know, I got caught up with this job. I don't care what you got caught up with. Get the film done.
Right.
So I edit all my own stuff now. I'm pretty much like a Robert Rodriguez. I do a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
And the thing is it enables me to get stuff done quickly and proficiently.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I'm shooting a film, yes, I do have people that help out with crew.
Right.
But I try to keep it really minimal. Like I'll have somebody for continuity and wardrobe and somebody to help feed people, maybe somebody to move around light stands and stuff.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much it. I don't like to have a bunch of people walking around.
Sure. Well, that I remember the one of the first like large scale commercials I did, and there were three of us in the commercial. There was me and two kids. And that was kind of my initial niche, was like young suburban dad.
Yeah.
And it was me and two kids, and it was a commercial for Hungry Jack mashed potatoes, and there were just the three of us, and there were about 40 to 50 people on that crew.
Yeah, it's night and day, and I tell you what, one of the producers for the show I shot, we had dinner one night because she came in town one of the nights, and this woman's done really big TV shows, and she would tell me when she first started, I mean, they would have like 15 people and all these Pelican cases, they'd fly in, and all the setup, and now it's like you can use a tiny little mirrorless camera,
right?
You know, and a little basic 3-point lighting setup, and get what you need.
Yeah,
you know, and it is night and day. But sometimes, even when you have those big productions, you know, does it look that much better?
Right.
And you know what? It's okay. I'm not an actor. I've done a couple commercials. My son used to do acting, and his agent would get me stuff. And I booked a gig for Fairway, and I did this meat commercial.
Yeah.
And so anyways, and I got there, and I was like, okay, I have hair and makeup. I have no hair. This is easy. And the whole store shut down, and all the lights in the ceiling, they had taken out certain bulbs and set up other ones, and you know, the giant, you know, screen on the little push cart, and cameras about that big. And it looked really good when I watched it, but I thought, I bet you could do that with half that stuff.
Right.
And it would look the same.
Right.
You know, but I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know enough. And this was something that for me was, I didn't realize was such a big difference between film and theater, was I don't know enough about the technical aspects of lighting. And like, I know my way around a basic camera, you know, but so many other of those elements of filmmaking, those technical elements, like I haven't had the training or haven't played around enough to really learn them. So it's hard for me to say from that perspective, but I know I've done shoots that have been super low budget and small that have looked great.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done stuff that's been really big that's come out and you're like, yeah.
You know, and that's so true. That's so true. I mean, I talk to a lot of filmmakers and, you know, one way or the other, sometimes people, they'll bring up like budget or something, which I tend not to get into, but you know, but it's crazy. I've talked to people that have had huge budgets, $500,000, and it looks like a high school production.
Sure.
You know, and they had all the people and all the help, or, you know, I've seen some where the visuals looked amazing, but the audio was horrible.
Yeah.
And you got that echoey sound and, you know, the real bad scratching from the mic and.
Yeah. I remember one of the first indie films I did. It was a student film, and it was like a 20-25 minute film, and it was this director, and he was doing like a film noir version, and he was very meticulous, like, and his shots looked all really good, but the sound, like, they got into post and the sound was terrible.
Yeah.
And, like, they did the best they could with it, but, like, you watch the film and you're like, yeah, this is really bad sound. And it makes such a difference, you know, kind of like we were talking about lighting earlier. Like, when it's good, you don't notice it, but you notice that it looks good.
Yeah, and you know, I think, too, it's just you don't have to have super expensive equipment. Mm-hmm. You can buy knockoff generic lighting and audio equipment and get really good results if you set your levels correctly. Mm-hmm. And just kind of learn, like, if you're going to put wireless mics on people, you have to learn that there's a secret on how you tape that stuff up so you don't get all that scratching noise.
Right.
You know, and certain capsules sound better on other people, or that 32-bit float doesn't mean your audio is going to be perfect. Not if it's wireless. It doesn't work on wireless. It only works if you're hardwired in. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of things that if you figure that stuff out, you'll get better results. But,
yeah,
you know, it's amazing, though, today, honestly. I mean, what technology we have at our disposal.
Yeah.
There is no excuse not to make something. If you want to make it, you can make it.
Yeah. I know the Duplass brothers are always such big proponents of, like, you've got a phone in your pocket that can make a movie. Like, if you want to make a movie, go make the movie. You don't need to wait until you have the Red or the Dragon or whatever camera that you think you need to make that project.
Absolutely. And I love about them, too, is their first film, I don't remember the name of it, but it was like, I think it aired on Sundance, and it was like about an answering machine message.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen it?
Mm-mm.
Really good film. But if you watch it, I mean, it's not really high production value. I mean, the audio I don't think was that great either, but it was a really catchy story, and I can see why that kind of got them noticed.
Sure.
But they had an interview, and I don't want to misquote them, but it was something like they thought that once they kind of like got into Sundance or got their first movie deal or whatever, that the cavalry was coming and everything was going to get easier. But in reality, that wasn't the case. They still had to figure out how to get their own money and get their own excitement. And
yeah. You know. Well, you think back to, and, you know, I assume we're in the ballpark age-wise and filmmaker reference-wise, but, like, think about Clerks.
Yeah.
And, like, that was certainly not a high-budget film by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, like you said, like, if you have that interesting story or something that's going to hook people, when you're writing, maybe we can kind of transition, like, because you do a lot of your own things, like, what are the types of stories you like to tell?
I love all stories, man. I write really quick.
Yeah.
So not counting the screenplays that I've written for clients and other projects, I probably have 25 feature-length screenplays I'm sitting on right now. And actually, I had a client that passed away. I did a couple projects for, and he left me all his scripts in his will. So I have another 22 of his screenplays.
Oh, wow.
So I have a lot of scripts. But
yeah.
I love drama.
Mm-hmm.
I love slow burn thriller. And I do like slapstick dumb humor, like comedy.
Sure.
Napoleon Dynamite type stuff.
Yeah.
Which is hard because you need actors that aren't trying to be funny, that can play things with a straight face. And that can be difficult overseas. You know, humor doesn't always translate.
Right.
But honestly, you know, it is business. So, you know, it's like as far as like what's the next project, you know, I'm looking at that right now thinking, you know, what should be the next project? You know, because depending on who you talk to, they have different views as far as what's going to be sellable or not. And sometimes there are projects that me personally, I wouldn't be interested in doing.
Right.
I don't want to write a romantic comedy, but if that's what's going to, you know, open the next door, then so be it.
Yeah. I remember being in theater school and a young, very idealistic artist and saying, I never want to do commercials. I only want to do the art.
Yeah.
And then I saw the commercial checks and I was like, I'm going to do some commercials.
Why not?
Yeah.
I mean, why not?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good little thing to do.
It was not selling out the way my younger self envisioned it would be.
No, and I'm sure that, like, if you research all your favorite actors, I'm sure they did a bazillion commercials background roles or whatever to kind of get their break.
Yeah, you got to get your break. You got to get your start and get, and as an actor, get experience in front of the camera, because it's, especially if you're coming from a theater background, it's so different.
Yeah.
Like, there are things that are the same in terms of creating characters and your methodology, but acting in front of a camera technique is so different from technique I use for theater.
Absolutely. So. But, you know, a lot of it, I think, is just getting in that mindset that you're becoming that character. You're still Ben. You still talk the same and all that, but you're Ben playing Jeff.
Right.
And Jeff is a serial killer, and he loves cats or whatever. I mean, you have to...
Well, that was my other niche, other than Suburban Dad, was Suburban Dad with a secret.
What's the secret?
I killed people or...
Yeah.
There was one, I ran a BDSM dungeon, like in my part-time. So there's all sorts of stuff.
Cut the interview.
Well, we've been chatting forever, and I feel like we could keep going on, but what's next? What are the projects you're excited about that you want to tell the people about to keep their eyes out for?
So, okay, I got evidently the documentary I'm doing with the film office, and I have a feature film I did called The Hartford House. It's a slow burn, like, suspense mystery film, and that is, the edit is done, the visual effects are done, just got to do the color and the sound of the music.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm excited about that. We're going to try the festival route and see what happens.
Cool.
And then beyond that, you know, I've got a bunch of different people I'm talking to about projects. I've got somebody that wants me to go to another country to film a project. I don't know if that's going to pan out or not, but we've been going back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I have another potential project that is set in the South during slavery times, and it's based on a true story. So we're doing a little bit of research for that and seeing if there's raise a little bit of capital for that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it takes a lot of time because I'm primarily like production services. So in other words, it's like people already have a budget.
Sure.
You know, and whether it be a documentary, a short film, a book adaptation, that's kind of what I do. That's my lane.
Yeah.
But, you know, for the right project, I would be interested in trying to, you know, get behind it and figuring things out. But I think you have to have a team of people that know what they're doing, and they're all willing to knock on doors and do what they have to do.
Right.
And most don't want to do that.
Right.
Which is hard. But I'm trying to keep filmmaking alive in the Quad Cities. I mean, I know there's like fresh films and all that, but there's mm-hmm. really not a lot here.
Right. Well, you're doing a great job. There's lots going on in the Quad Cities, I think, with film. There's a lot of people who are trying to elevate it. And I know for me, when I see your vehicle around with Volker Films, it's like people are out doing stuff.
Trying.
So, yeah. Keep up the great work, Stephen.
You betcha.
Yeah. Pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, you too.
Finally. And thanks for being on. Thanks again to our sponsors, Quad City Bank and Trust, and to our wonderful producer, the man behind the mix, Mr. Josh Graves. This is Ben Gujan. Oh, for more information on Stephen and Volker Films, you can visit www.volkerfilms.com. I'm Ben Gujan. This is Talking Art.